Today, we're going to explore the first signs that your contractor is cutting corners. But before we get into that, we need to talk about a couple things first. So what is cutting corners and why do contractors do it? Now, first, let's get into what cutting corners is and is not. And so a lot of people, especially those who aren't in the game of real estate investing, certain things and believe that's cutting corners. And so we talk here a lot about smart scopes of work, which means deciding what is needed on a property as opposed to what is wanted. A lot of people treat these quote unquote investments like it's their personal house. In fact, you'll hear a lot of people say, you know, I want to make it like I would live in it. Well, that's not really what you want to do with a real estate investment. What you want to do is you want to determine what type of neighborhood that house is in. You want to figure out what else has sold or rented in that neighborhood, and then find out what shape those houses are in. What type of renovation has been done in those houses? Going beyond that renovation may seem like the thing to do. However, it is just diminishing returns or no returns at all. See, every dollar that you spend on a house should be able to have a direct line to $1.01 put back into your pocket. If it doesn't, it's just a dumb investment. Now, that doesn't mean there's not other things for it. Maybe you do prioritize making pretty things over making great investments. But you just have to be honest with yourself that that is what you're doing. If you're doing things just to have prettier pictures in your portfolio, well, that's not investing. Now, maybe there is a bigger picture plan that you have, but per that one investment, not a good decision. The best decision is to find what the minimum amount of things you need to do to get to the level that the other houses are selling or renting for in that neighborhood, and then get there. Just barely there, because everything else past there has diminishing returns. So that's what I mean, basically, when I talk about making a smart scope of work. What I don't mean is cutting out things like safety and liability, codes. Those things have to be done. Cutting those things out is cutting corners. These are infrastructure type of items that I'm talking about. Let me give you some examples. Fire alarms. Wiring a house to code. You could hide a lot inside of walls. That is cutting corners. Plumbing to code. You can hide a lot inside of walls and underneath floors, and people will do that when they get in trouble on properties. On the renovation, contractors will do that when they get into financial trouble on a renovation. Making sure that windows in bedrooms are egress, meaning somebody could escape from them. That's a safety item. And if that's not taken care of, you're definitely cutting corners. That's what being a slumlord is about, is doing things that are going to actually cause people harm if you don't fix it. And being a slumlord and cutting corners is kind of hand in hand. But on the other hand, deciding to do a cheap tub surround as opposed to a nice tile, well, that's just being smart, possibly, depending on the neighborhood that you're in. If you're in a nice A-class property in an A-class neighborhood, well, it's probably not smart to put in the cheap tub surround. But if you're in a C-class property in a rental-mainly neighborhood with maybe a lower-income neighborhood, well, it's probably smarter to put the tub surround in, because doing the tile isn't going to get you more rent, and it's not going to make your house worth more money. So one more thing about cutting corners. Everything is about your scope of work. So setting a clear scope of work that details every job, every task that is going to be done on a project is what you need to learn to do. And you pass that on to the contractor and you make sure you're aligned on exactly what you expect on that project. Now, if you've done that, it's pretty simple to understand what cutting corners really is. Cutting corners is when a contractor doesn't do the things that you agreed upon on the scope of work, and they don't do it and they hide not doing it inside of the walls or by other means. That is cutting corners. So two things at play here. There's making the smart scope of work, which is mainly going to be done by you as the investor. And if you cut out those safety and liability things that we were discussing, that makes you a slumlord, or that makes you a corner cutter as a real estate investor, a salesperson. And then there is really what we're talking about in this video or this podcast of cutting corners, which is when you hand a scope of work to a contractor, they agree upon it, and then they don't complete that scope of work as you agreed upon it. And they try to hide it in most cases. Here are the most common corner cuts for each of the most popular jobs that we would do on a project. Most popular, most used jobs. Demo, unclean edges or stopping points. For example, they pull off drywall and just stop where it breaks instead of cutting clean ends. Now, somebody down the line, somebody later in the project, is going to have to finish their work. Framing. Undersized headers, incorrect spacing between studs, you know, not 16-inch centers or 24-inch centers, not enough fasteners or strapping. You know, that's a way that framers will save money and time, is they won't put enough nails in. You know, you have to have a certain amount of nails in each framing member, piece of wood. Insulation, not enough depth blown into the attic. So each region of the United States will have a different R value attached to ceiling insulation, wall insulation, and under the floor crawl space insulation. That R value basically comes down to the depth of the pink stuff that you see. There are other ways to do insulation, but that's the most common that you'll see by far. The pink stuff, the depth of it indicates how much of the heat it keeps in the house. So the deeper it is, the better R value that it has. So for instance, a wall that has 2x4 studs can only have R13 pink insulation. You can get more R value by spraying foam instead of putting in the pink stuff. That's much more expensive. A 2x6 wall can have R19, has better R value. And then in a ceiling, for instance, here in the southeast region, we need R38 in the attic space. But instead of putting the rolled insulation like you might in the wall, a lot of times what you'll do is you'll go into the attic and you'll blow in the insulation. And you actually have to take a ruler and stick it down there to figure out how deep it is. And, you know, there's charts that will tell you the depth and what R value that makes. But what contractors will do to cut corners is they'll not put in the proper depth, or they'll use R13 in an R19 wall. Roofing, no drip edge, insufficient flashing, skipping the venting. I've seen that happen on a lot of roofs where there won't be any venting and you won't know it unless you're looking for it. Electrical. General poor connections, splices inside of the walls, undersized wire gauge, plumbing, insufficient venting, improper sloping of the line. You know, a sewer line has to have a certain amount of drop per foot, and sometimes contractors will not do the correct amount of sloping because the space is too limited to get it there. They'd have to do a lot of extra work to make it happen. Also, strapping. So you're supposed to strap those every X amount of feet. I believe it's every 2 or 4 feet, but that's why you have a code book around. HVAC, undersized unit or ductwork. Drywall, less screws than are needed. There are actually codes, rules about how many screws you need around the perimeter of a piece of drywall and down the center. This is really considered part of what the code calls the building envelope, the thing that gives your structure strength. And so in some municipalities, they actually come and inspect the screw pattern, and some they don't. And this is where you'll catch people cutting some corners. Also, if the paper is broken through by the screw, it is not counted as a screw because it's lost its strength. Also with drywall, just a general shoddy finish. It's tough because you don't want to be too micromanagey and shine a flashlight down the wall and find every imperfection. Some imperfection is acceptable. We actually did some work for a popular hotel chain who I think that their room for error was something like 20 or 30%, which was much more than I had figured. But that number left a mark in my head. But just look at your own house. Like, it's not perfect. It's good, but it's not perfect if you shined a flashlight across it. But if it's too bad, once you put the paint on, then it kind of shows all the imperfections. And if it's too bad, it's pretty tough to fix the drywall after you put the paint on. So you do want to do some checking there. Missing closets or the backside of doors. This is where you find people who are cutting corners. Just look in the closet or behind the door. Also, the biggest one for me of all of these is paint on the hinges. It makes me really angry when people paint the hinges or doorknobs. You know, they haven't taken the doorknobs off or they haven't taken the electrical plates off before painting, and then they get paint on those things. It is just the ultimate sign of I don't care about your project. Floors, lazy cuts around the doors and the corners. You shouldn't be able to see any of the subfloor. So you want to make sure that it all gets up tight, and you want to make sure at the exterior door of your house, usually the flooring will butt up to it as opposed to go underneath the threshold. And so that really needs to be perfect. Those are spots to look for. Undercutting the doors too high. When you're installing flooring, you use a tool to undercut the jamb and trim at the bottom of the door so you can slide the flooring underneath it. Some people will cut it way too high where there's like a quarter inch gap underneath and it looks really bad. And then maybe they try to caulk it and then it looks even worse. You should be running the same flooring throughout as much as you can because it makes houses feel better and more congruent. It increases the perceived value of the house, whether the buyer or renter knows it or not. It also increases the strength in most cases. But what people will do is, since they didn't think it through all the way, they'll just stop the flooring at doors and then start new and put a transition strip in. But if you really think through the layout, you can usually run it smoothly, transitionless, through every room of the house, and that's the preferred method. Trim, sloppy joints, too much space between the trim and the wall, using the phrase, we'll just caulk it later. Now, a little bit of that is actually okay. When they put the trim on, there are going to be small gaps that need caulked by the painter when they come in. Sometimes people are leaving huge gaps and they're saying, well, it'll just get caulked later. And most of the time, that's just because it's bad carpentry. In some houses, the floors are really uneven. The house is unlevel. And if you put the cabinets or countertops in level to an actual level, it would make the house look really wonky. It would expose the unlevelness of those floors. I believe what a good carpenter is able to do is match their carpentry work to the house. Now, maybe some of you are thinking, well, that's shoddy from the start. You should absolutely fix those floors before you do any work on the house. Yeah, well, I guess so. I guess you should tear down the house and build it new every time. There'd never be a deal to be had because you'd have to get everybody's house for pennies. And then everybody would be mad about you trying to get everybody's house for pennies. And so the key in houses that need rehabs is you got to let some of the things go. It's okay to have a little bit of sloping as long as there's no structural damage. Windows, missing flashing or seals, installed in a way that will make trimming out siding extra hard. It's the unfortunate thing about a lot of these is you don't find out the corner's been cut until they've been paid and the next contractor's in. It's another reason why a lot of times we like to use all-arounders, people who do a lot of different things. And so we kind of hire them out for most of a project. So they're doing a lot of these jobs and then we can bring them back and hold accountability. Otherwise, you really have to check through these things. Gutters don't slope correctly. Poorly placed downspouts that don't actually run away from the house. The whole intention of gutters and downspouts is to get the water off of your house. And sometimes these downspouts are set up in a way where the water just comes right back at your house anyway, so you might as well have never had it. Decks, setting posts and beams incorrectly. I see so many decks out there that are not built correctly. It's really simple. In any sort of structure, you have to start with a footing that spreads the load across the ground. depending on your municipality, it needs to be deeper in the ground or shallower. I mean, it doesn't need to be shallower, but it just doesn't need to be that deep because of the frost line. For instance, the frost line here is 12 inches. When I lived in Denver, it was 36 inches. So a footing had to be below that frost line. So in Denver, I would have to dig 3 feet into the ground before I put a footer down. Here, I have to basically take a scoop of dirt out and I'm below the frost line. Then you pour a footer, which is generally a concrete pad that spreads however much is required. Might be a foot by a foot, might be 2 foot by 2 foot, might be 4 inches thick. In structural work in a house where you're holding up a lot of things, it's going to be a lot bigger, whereas for a deck, it might be a lot smaller. Got your footer, that's your concrete pad. On top of that sits the posting, which that's what you see on a deck. The post that comes out of the ground sits on top of this thing, usually separated by what's called a Simpson tie, and then sits the beam or the rim of the beam, but it sits on top. This is where most of the mistakes are made. Is it used to be that people would just smack the beam on the outside of that post and, you know, put big screws through it or lag bolts, but it is required for it to be sitting on top of that post. So that way the weight of the beam, the load that is on the beam, because the beam holds all of the floor joists, which on top of the floor joist goes the deck boards that you see. But all of that load is on that beam, which sits on top of the post, which sits on top of the footer. If you put the beam on the outside of the post, the real thing that would be holding up all of that would be the screws, the strength of the screws and the friction of the two pieces of wood being held together. That's not as good as all the weight being sitting on top of that footer. Doors don't latch or they rub. One note here is a lot of times doors will get installed appropriately and then the HVAC will get turned on and the climate will change just enough for the doors to start rubbing. So this might not be a corner cutting thing. This might just be a change of climate. Also something to think about when you're managing your project. Tile, not enough adhesive or mortar behind them. This is a big one that corner cutters can really get away with, is instead of putting the appropriate amount of adhesive on, they put just enough to stick it on the wall and then it makes a problem later. It should have a whole bed of mortar or adhesive and it should get scraped so that way it mushes out. You've seen like the scrapers. How do you check for that? Because once it's on the wall or on the floor, you can't really see it anymore. And so how would you know that they were doing that correctly? Well, I have found that if you take like a screwdriver or something like that and tap on it, you can hear if it's hollow underneath or not. And there would be voids underneath if they weren't using the appropriate amount. Now you might find some that have little voids in there, but if a lot of them do, you'll have problems down the road. Those voids will make it easy for them to get cracked. You're basically making little bridges all over the place where, you know, weight can crack the tile. That's where when something falls on the tile, it cracks because there is a void underneath in a lot of cases. Why do contractors cut corners? Well, because they're pieces of trash, right? Maybe in some cases. And I have done a whole video on the top types of dirty contractors. And there really are dirty contractors out there. I've run into plenty of them. For the most part, these are honest guys trying to make an honest living. And I think that the reason corners get cut is a few, but mostly it's because they get their back against the wall and don't know what to do. And the construction business really is difficult. As a lot of you guys know, in addition to all the houses that we flip for our own rentals or to sell, we also run a construction company. So we deal with a lot of the same kind of stuff. And it really is a razor thin margin type of industry. And I used to be much bigger into the construction side where we were really growing and scaling that business. And it's just a industry that's been around for a while. And so all the margins have been cut and it's tough to make a living. And if you're not a slick business operator, a lot of times you get behind the eight ball. And when you get behind the eight ball, sometimes people make bad decisions. Imagine this. There are three different contractors that come to bid a job, same time or right around the same time. And the one contractor has a crew and they're about to finish up another project that they're on. And he's thinking, man, I got to make sure that this crew or this job gets won so that way I can keep the crew working and I can get them paid. Otherwise, I'll either have to pay them without having good work where I get paid, or I'll have to let them go. And then how hard was it to find that crew with the labor shortage or whatever they're thinking? And I can't go out there and find another crew. And so I got to make sure that I keep these guys. And, you know, I have these bills and those bills coming up. And I need to win this job by any means necessary. But there's these other guys bidding it. And so maybe they bid it a little bit too low. Not in a nefarious way, necessarily. Maybe they just bid it very optimistically, thinking, well, I won't make much money off of this, but at least I'll cover all my costs and keep the guys working, which is great, except for nothing ever works out as planned. Therefore, these things come up. They have to call the customer for change orders, but the customer gets really upset about that. Obviously, we would too. And so then another thing comes up and the contractor starts thinking, oof, I don't want to bring that up again because I don't like uncomfortable conversations either. Therefore, then they think, well, maybe I can just, you know, skimp on this one little thing here. And, you know, there's a corner cut. There's varying degrees of that. And that's a lot of times where it happens is because a bad bid got made and accepted, and the options are pretty tough at that point. I'm not saying that's okay to do. I'm not saying there's anything good about that. I'm saying it is what happens. Or I guess another piece of that is a lot of these guys out there, you see, it's really easy to get to become a contractor. Not a good one or an experienced one, but you can become a contractor fairly simply. If you want to go be a painter, you can just say you're a painter and now you're a painter. And there are a lot of those guys out there. And so how are they going to know how to bid appropriately? Now, there is a little bit of a pro tip there on verifying if a guy has experience or not. I find that if you have somebody walk you through a project, you know, explain what they would do on the project that you're asking them for, that you can kind of determine whether they have experience or not. You see, somebody with experience is able to basically roll off the tip of their tongue exactly what they would do because they can envision it from all the experience they've had in the past. Whereas a novice, it will feel more like they're reading it off of a checklist that they maybe read about or are manifesting as they speak. Experience, it just sits there. And they're able to roll through it. Now we are ready for the first signs that your contractor's cutting corners. First signs that they've run into some issues and they're going to be faced with a choice, whether they cut corners or they come to you to make a change. First is the black hole, the most common thing that happens. Everything's going well, and then all of a sudden, the contractor stops showing up at the job site. He's hard to get a hold of. You know, the communication is intermittent, happens sometimes, doesn't happen for multiple days in a row. And it's not that they've completely ghosted you. It's that they're just very sparse in their appearances. This generally happens for one of two reasons. They've run out of money on your project and are trying to make up for it in some other ways. Maybe they've taken on another project. They're robbing Peter to pay Paul, a common thread in the construction game. They've overcommitted their workload, meaning they've taken on too many projects than they can actually operate. Also very common. You have to think about this. They always need to be thinking about where their next paycheck is going to come from. So they are out there recruiting for other projects. And then when they get one, they kind of have to start it right away. I mean, think about yourself. If you talk to a contractor and they said, oh, well, yeah, I have a list. I have these four jobs lined up and I'll be able to start yours 3 months from now. What would you do? You'd go get another job or another contractor to do that job. And so they kind of have to take it and they kind of have to start it right away. So now they've overcommitted and now they are trying to figure it out, but maybe it's harder to figure out than they thought it was going to be. And I'm sure a lot of you guys are listening and you're like, oh, well, you know, that's not how I run my business. Well, that's how most people that we work with end up running their business. So how do you deal with somebody who has started to enter the black hole? Well, first, you need to give them an ultimatum. And it's got to be a realistic ultimatum. What a lot of people do in this situation is they're pretty teed off that they're getting blackholed. And so they respond with a high level of emotion. And that is not the way to do this. You need to sit down, think about what is a reasonable ask in knowing what we just talked about, but also protecting yourself first. And let's just say that it's a flooring job that they're doing. I would say something along the lines of, hey, it's been really hard to get a hold of you. I have tried to reach you on these three different occasions and I've had no real response. And those would be true things that have happened that I can prove happened. And I really need to get this flooring job done so I can move this project forward. Therefore, I'm going to give you 2 weeks to have this completed. And at that point, if it is not completed, I'm going to have to let you go. We'll figure out the pay and I'm going to move on to somebody else. 2 weeks is ample time to finish a flooring job. And you have done your best to give them the opportunity and you've done it all in writing. So if you have to let them go, you let them go and you'll have your paper trail of what has happened there. But I doubt any of that is actually going to go into a court situation unless you try to skimp on pay completely. I'm sure they have done some work, or maybe they did nothing at all. And then that's a lot easier to cut ties from. I guess I'm talking about somebody who started work and actually made progress. Now, they're not going to get the amount of progress that they have made paid out. Let me explain. Let's say the project is $5,000 worth. You know, the labor is $5,000 worth. And they've done 50% of the floors. So it seems reasonable that they would ask for $2,500, half of the $5,000, but it's not. They've done the easier part. The hard part is at the end. And also when you go to bid out the job, nobody likes to take over somebody's work. And so that second half is going to get bid a lot higher. And so it is not worth 50% of the cost or 50% of the bid price. So know that. But you do need to be reasonable in the pay. I wouldn't probably stiff them completely. I would negotiate some sort of pay with them. Next is pay schedule bending. Part of every scope of work is a pay schedule that you both agree upon. And, you know, we use our checkpoints and that's how we generally pay people is once they've reached this checkpoint or the end of this phase, we pay X amount that we've agreed upon and that's that. But it needs to be clear the expectation of what needs to be done before you pay what amount. What pay schedule bending is when they start trying to get paid before they've wrapped those things up. And usually this happens because they've run out of money or they don't trust you. But mostly they ran out of money. And this happens a lot, especially in the rehabs for investor part of the industry. And you just got to say no. It sucks because they probably do need the money. There's always a great story on why they need the money, but you just got to say no. This is what we agreed upon. You need to make sure that you've set the expectation very clear in written that they've agreed upon that these things need to be done before I pay. But then just don't pay after that until they've reached the thing that we've agreed upon. They've failed to get permits and they're hiring unlicensed people and they're doing it for work that needs licensed and permitted. Now, I am no Boy Scout. I'm not calling people out. I don't care what your quote unquote strategy is around this stuff. I know a lot of people who don't get permits and try to avoid that whole thing. I'm not saying that's right. I'm saying it happens. But what we're talking about is that you have hired people, and the default mindset should be that it needs to be done to code for sure, and that permits are getting pulled. So the work that needs to be done is would pass any inspection that you needed to get with the city. The level of work that they are doing, they know would not pass an inspection. Therefore, they avoid inspections. They are hiding shoddy work that they know you won't know to look for, but a city inspector would. Or finally, they're so unorganized that they just can't handle the administrative stuff. And that disorganization ultimately will bleed into the work that they do on your project. Response? Well, this one is really upfront. You need to check these things is mainly what you need to do. And response, if you find the things, you kind of have to stop and fix it. This one could catch you. And once again, not a Boy Scout here, but I am sending you out a warning. I've seen a lot of people get to ends of projects where they weren't going to pull permits and such. They get to ends of projects and then they have to open up all the walls and all that kind of stuff. And that just generally catches up with you. The people that I've seen, quote unquote, get away with that are usually doing cosmetic things. And maybe there's a couple things they do on a project where it might bend those rules and they go ahead and do those. That's different than doing full out renovations. It's a dangerous game you're playing there. Next is a barrage of change orders. Well, what is it? This is where they keep finding things that are going to cost a little bit of extra. And truly, some contractors use a loss leader approach, which means they give you a bid that they know is not going to make them much money because they know once they're in the house, they're going to find extra work or get extra work out of you. And, you know, that really does work in retail type of projects, you know, for homeowners that are living in the home. Usually once they get in there, there's like these extra things they want to do and the people mark those up higher. I think that's more of like maybe a legitimate marketing kind of thing. Maybe. I don't know. I don't do the nicer retail work anymore. We used to in the past. But investors, if you're a good investor, you have set a smart scope of work and you don't want to alter that at all. You don't have any dreams about the nice extra stuff you want to do. And once the contractor gets in there, you start asking them to do it. You should have a plan that you're going to stick to right from the start. And so if they were a loss leader approach, now they're kind of like, oh gosh, I'm going to do this whole project and not make any money. And so then the things start coming up. So once again, it just comes down to the money. You know, people need to make money to do the things. And if they're not making the money, they need to find a way to make the money. And one way is to come talk to you about making the money. Another way is to eat it, which is really tough for a lot of people to eat it. And then the final way is to cut a little bit here and there, a little corner here and there. Some really bad, some not so bad. Now, I do think that it is also my responsibility to make sure that people have bid correctly. Other people might not feel this way. You might think, ooh, the lower the bid I can get from the contractor and then hold them to it, the better. And I have thought that way in my lifetime for sure. And now I think more about the long-term relationship because it's really nice to have a depth chart of guys that I can call and they want to pick up the phone and they want to go do nice work because they know there's more work coming. And so when they get into trouble, I am more inclined to help out. And also when they give me a bid that I know is too low, I question it just like I question a bid that's too high. Now, seeing one of these signs doesn't necessarily mean that your contractor is cutting corners, but it definitely should raise some red flags in your mind. As I've stated before, cutting corners usually doesn't mean that a contractor is malintended. It's simple mismanagement in one way or another, and this is a tough business to manage. But in most cases, I do believe that you are in control of whether these corners get cut or not. Yeah, you're going to run into some malintended bad contractors who are strategically going to cut these corners on you. But I think that you can prevent these things from happening. Like things what we were just talking about, like making sure that a contractor has a good bid. If you've gotten three bids at $10,000 and then somebody comes in at $5,000, well, they probably missed something. And if you're going to try to hold their feet to the fire, well, something bad is probably going to happen. If you keep pressing on people to get the pricing answer you want or the timeline answer you want when they've told you that it's not possible, well, something's going to give. And, you know, a lot of times real estate investors, we know how to negotiate and how to push on things and how to get people to give answers we want. And that works a lot of times in negotiations, especially in white collar world. But you know, these guys have to carry out this work and it might just not be possible financially to carry out the work that they've agreed to. So if you push them into a corner where they, because they don't have the same negotiation skills you have and they don't know how to face that correctly, then you may get the answer you want, but you won't get the result you want. And it might come in a way that you don't know. What am I actually trying to say with all of this? I guess it's easy to read what I'm saying as saying that when a corner gets cut, it's actually your fault as the customer, not the contractor's fault. Well, that's not true. That's not what I'm saying at all. It is definitely their fault. But you don't control the contractor. You control yourself. And it is my job, or what I'm trying to do out there, is to educate you so you can be better protected out there in the marketplace. I'm trying to show you in my 15 years of experience what it actually looks like out there for these contractors and how to manage that correctly. And it, of course, starts by managing yourself correctly and controlling the things that you can control. And that's what this is about. So thanks for tuning in. And I talk a lot about this type of stuff. And check out this next one.